Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, well, I never set out to do workshops particularly. It wasn't on my bucket list, but I found that I had a knack for doing it. I realised that I was good at teaching, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed looking at other people's processes, and it helped me to develop my own. So I began working with the over 50s in Cardiff. They were long-term unemployed and were a very interesting group as well, people with a lot of life experience, but also who had been around a little bit, who I would say were slightly disillusioned. Some of them were down on their luck, and I just found it rewarding. We did a couple of days and then ended up doing a gig in a library, then progressed to teaching teenagers, which was as challenging as it sounds. Everything from a group of 10 to one guy who just said, look, my mum just doesn't like me very much. I don't even like comedy. But it turns out that 6 years later, Moggsy, as he's known, is doing really well on the comedy circuit. So I found the whole process rewarding, really. And then Alfie from We Are Funny Project said to me, would you like to do a storytelling workshop? And I thought, well, yes, I would, because storytelling, or as I'm now beginning to call it, interactive narrative, that should be my trademark, is what I feel I do best. And I thought, well, I've been around a little bit. I've been around the block many times. I've had quite a journey. And I thought I would like to be able to share my knowledge, really, and present a workshop that would answer the questions that I wish someone had told me when I first started out.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry Podcast, episode 57. For those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, TV, and today, storytelling. Matt Price is a comedian and a performer who's been on the circuit for years as a storyteller, or as he likes to put it, a postmodern interactive narrative storytelling comedian. We get into why he's chosen to give himself a pretentious title like that, the difference between a storyteller and a stand-up comedian, his relationship with the label of a storyteller, why so many comedians think being a storyteller is a label that you get when you're not being funny, and why clubs don't understand or book storytellers. Loads of information in this about how to tell stories, and we actually did the podcast directly after being at his course for an afternoon where I learnt loads about how to deliver a story and how to tell a story on stage. So if you'd like more information on that, there'll be links in the show notes. I'm not going to say much more because I want to just get straight into it. So if you're enjoying this podcast, please do remember to subscribe, and without any more delays, this is Matt Price.
So the difference between stand-up and storytelling for me is an interesting question, obviously. I think that storytelling now, it's interesting, most people will describe themselves, I say most people, as a storyteller to one degree or another. You look at people, look at comedy CV, the phrases that are used the most are the hardest working act in the UK, fastest rising star, and storyteller. The difference for me is that a storyteller has a narrative in whatever form. That's it. I think that stand-up and storytelling, it's more merged now than it's ever been. I find it quite interesting that in recent years at the Edinburgh Festival, storytelling has been a separate genre. It's been introduced to something. Now you can actually describe your show as stand-up storytelling. So in fact, the lines are becoming a lot more blurred. But if you're looking traditionally, I always think that storytelling actually looked originally like an excuse for not having any jokes and for not being particularly funny. If you'd have said, I'm a storyteller 10 years ago, people would think, oh, right, you've got a big beard and you're extremely earnest. and you talk about in Elizabethan English, and you're not funny. Now, of course, it's changed. The Edinburgh Festival features people who are doing hour-long storytelling shows. I didn't even realise that I was doing that. So my answer is actually, it's very blurred. Mm. It's extremely blurred. And the fact that stand-up storytelling exists is actually quite handy for me. I think, however, traditionally, stand-up is probably... I hear people say it all the time, yeah, but I'm more like gag, 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 joke, 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 gag, 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 you know, bang, bang, bang. And it's fine. And I believe that. But I also say to them, yeah, well, good luck doing that for an hour. And the beauty of it is with storytelling, I think that once you know what it is and once an audience, particularly in Edinburgh, knows what it is, for me personally, it's more rewarding. Don't get me wrong. I'd love to be Bill Burr and be hilarious for an hour and go seamlessly from one topic to another. But that isn't what I do. I like to create a show where there is a narrative, where there's a point to it. More recently, I've started to offer opinions. And I like the arc. I like the beginning, middle and end. I like what it's about. And then allowing the audience to discover along the journey what it's really about. So I wouldn't say that storytelling is more in depth than stand-up. It's the little brother or sister. But now, increasingly, as it's evolving and more people are doing it, the lines are becoming a lot blurrier.
Yeah, I mean, we've just done your course. And I remember you bringing up Comedy CV in the course, and I didn't want to dwell on it too much at the time, but it's one of those things where I think it was Richard Branson, I read, I think, his autobiography, and he said in it something like, an entrepreneur never calls themselves an entrepreneur, other people describe them as that. And that's why I kind of try and avoid things like fastest rising star, you know, hardest working, whatever, because I don't think Jimmy Carr's ever described himself as the hardest working comedian, but loads of people do. And yes, it's one of those things where it's sort of, is it not insulting, it's sort of just a bit weird that you would, it's like when a guy says, oh, I'm a really nice guy, you're like, you shouldn't have to say it. Everyone should just be aware of it, you know? And is that why you don't now label yourself as a story? You call yourself an interactive story?
It's slightly tongue-in-cheek, actually. I was in Australia at the start of the year with Gordon Southern, who I, you know, love as an act and as a bloke as well. And his show had a narrative. Mm. And the delightful thing about Gordon, he's a very funny man, but he's a cheeky, chappy guy. And the show, in many ways, was about his father's dementia. There's so much more to it than that. Mm. And, of course, he interacts with the audience as well. He's got a great way of interacting. It's a box of tricks, but it's very, very smart. And he uses an iPad, and he does bespoke raps for people, and he has various catchphrases that come out. And it could, I'm making it sound like he's a 1970s club entertainer. He's not. He's very much Gordon Southern. It's a great style. And he said to me about storytelling, well, you're a good storyteller. And I said, yeah, having watched you, you do interactive narrative. And I thought, oh, and he said, oh, I really like that. And I thought, yeah, that's kind of the phrase that I've just coined now. So I'm being slightly cheeky when I say, oh, well, I do interactive narrative. To be honest with you, I entertain the audience in front of me. It's as simple as that. You know, one of the things that I said in the workshop today was about, well, knowing what your range is, knowing what your persona is, knowing what it is you're trying to tell the audience, not necessarily second guessing them, but being very much in the room. So to just say, oh, yeah, I tell stories, I think is oversimplifying it.
Okay.
Because there are connotations to that. Because a lot of people say, yeah, well, it's not really joke, joke, joke. It depends on the story. It depends on the context. Sometimes a story will get broken up. Well, because I've been around the club circuit for so many years, I'm able to think, okay, someone's heckled with that. Oh, well, I can do A, B, or C. I know, I'll give them C. I'll get a laugh. And then I'll say, anyway, back to the story. Or I might go off on a little tangent. So it's not just as simple as, oh, yes, I tell stories. I interact. I play the room. I'll tell a yarn. I'll deal with anything that's going on. My duty as a comedian, especially on the club circuit, is to entertain and most of all make the audience laugh. Mm-hmm. I'll do anything but singing or nudity.
Okay, that sounds like your comedy CV there.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I totally get that, and I totally understand, because there are some clubs that are pure stand-up, and they don't have variety. There are some variety nights on the circuit now that, you know, they'll have storytelling, they'll have, although I'm sure, I don't know if you'd want to say any more on this, but I'm sure you probably don't necessarily, because I think even you said something in the course about Don Ward saying that his club's a comedy club, not a storytelling night.
Absolutely.
And so do you lose out on spots because of the perception of storytelling in some clubs?
Well, no, because I've started to describe myself as a guy who does interactive, joke-based narrative.
Okay.
And that's slightly different. You have to think more about that, you know, than just describing yourself as a storyteller. I mean, I'm a comedian, but my particular thing is I like to tell a good yarn.
Right.
You know, that's pretty much it. But I MC, you know, so I know the mechanics of a crowd and how it works. And within a story, I'll try and be as funny as possible. You know, there's no point. If you're at a comedy club, there's no point in doing anything that isn't comedic. Mm. You know, I'm not there to change people's lives. I know it might sound like it, although my thing, when I'm doing an hour show, that's a different beast altogether. But as a working comic, I think you need to be able to go anywhere in the world. I mean, I've performed in 30 countries. You know, to be able to turn up anywhere in the world, ideally, and entertain the people in front of you. So a story can be anything as well, from a minute and a half long to 10 minutes. You know, I got couple of stories that I can do in 2 minutes, which makes you think, well, hang on, how come you make them last 20? Well, because there's always bits, there's always tangents that you can go off on. And the fact that I've been on the club circuit for so long as well, that might be that you set up another narrative within the room as well. You can get two stories going. You can abandon a story. The other night I was in the West Country at a golf club, and one of the acts said to me, he said, that story seemed to last about 35 minutes. He said, I don't know how you managed to get them back in. They knew exactly where you were. Well, that's because of the experience and understanding the mechanics of how live comedy works. So it is an oversimplification to say, oh, yeah, I'm a storyteller. And I think that for me personally, my evolution, this is what I'm trying to share with people on the workshops as well. My evolution has been, well, I've learned from every gig over the last decade. And now I'm starting to reap the rewards. For me, I think it's an ideal opportunity to you can evolve at every gig. You can learn a tremendous amount from every gig. And for me, as a working professional comedian, it's ideal to be able to turn up and to be able to, if necessary, grind out a win. That sounds like such a cynical way to talk about comedy. But if you turn up and the 60 people at the British Dental Society and it's bright lighting and they don't really care about who you are and you get an introduction, which happened to me, oh, have you all heard of Live at the Apollo? Well, so has this guy. He's never been on it, Matt Price. It doesn't matter what you define yourself as. You've got to just come out and be funny.
And so you've coined this new term, and that's kind of given you this edge by the sounds of it, like that it stopped the stigma that maybe you had when you were a storyteller. Because we've spoken off pod a little bit, sort of it was the Murph Christmas party, where you were mentioning that storytelling doesn't necessarily get as much, did you describe it as respect or credibility?
It's not even respect or credibility. I think, honestly, in terms of storytelling and what a storytelling night is, I don't think storytelling has actually really started in the UK yet. In America, they do it brilliantly. They have the Moth, which is people telling true stories without notes live on stage. That's pretty much how they introduce it. There is Risk as well, which is with the podcast by Kevin Allison, which is risky stories. People tell stories that they wouldn't usually share. It's very compelling to watch. It's difficult to get that in the UK. We're a little bit behind the Americans. I mean, we were warned 10 years ago there was going to be a collapse in the UK, and guess what? It's happened. You know, we didn't listen. But it's made people more inventive, so there is a positive side to that. Storytelling hasn't really been done properly over here, not yet. When I used to co-run a storytelling night, Natural Born Storytellers, which is my trademark, the name that I came up with and used long before I did it in Camden, we weren't quite sure what the response would be. And I would invite comedians along and they would say, well, I don't really know what I'm meant to do, you know. And I'd say, well, you tell a story like you would to your mates, you know, beginning, middle and end. Yeah, but do I have to be funny? And I go, well, no, not really, just tell a story. Yeah, but what do you mean by a story? And I'd be tearing my hair out. Well, why can't you understand what a story is? It doesn't make any sense to me. And it was quite frustrating. You get people come along, understandably, because they don't know what it is. So it hasn't. There is a kind of a storytelling circuit, but it doesn't really exist. The best one is probably, well, Natural Born Storytellers still exists, and it's going very well from what I understand. But The Spark, now that's been going for about 10 years, and that's hosted by Martha, my partner. We both love Charlie Harrison, who's the host. She's also a comedian. She runs the Brixton Room for Spark. And the idea is that someone tells a story on stage and that sparks an idea in somebody else. It's very simple. And yet still, people don't understand what you mean by a storytelling night. Is it someone reading Little Red Riding Hood? And people will ask these questions. So it's not a question of being inferior, or it's just that it hasn't been clearly defined as a genre. Somebody needs to take storytelling and sex it up a little bit, right? You know, because at the moment it's just, well, what is it? And comedians always used to say,
you know, the lovely thing about it is, you know, there's no pressure to be funny, you know. And I go, yeah, but there's a pressure to tell a story. Well, what do you mean by a story? And I go, oh, God, I can't believe we're back to this again. So it just hasn't been clearly defined, which is a frustrating thing, but also quite exciting as well, in terms of potentially being the person who brings storytelling and makes it huge in the UK. I'm hoping that's what could happen.
And, I mean, it sounds like if... It's going to sound really flippant, and just bear with me. No. Well, you haven't said it yet.
Please be flippant. I'm fine.
Okay. I spoke to Earl Oaken about a week ago.
Okay.
He was originally in folk clubs.
Yes.
And then that collapsed. It went out of fashion.
Sure.
And he had to go into comedy clubs.
Yes.
And he still does folk clubs and jazz clubs and things.
Earl's great.
But yeah, oh, he's amazing.
Brilliant.
But he obviously he's had to subsidise that with comedy gigs because he writes some funny songs as well.
Yeah.
Do you think that? Just like we are just not a nation that particularly enjoys storytelling in that capacity, and we are much preferring of straight stand-up, because it could be that culturally America just is, you know, it's better over there, or because they like it over there, so they have more room to play with it and develop it. Or do you think it's just a case of we are 10 years behind them and we might get there at some point?
I just think we're 10 years behind. I really do. I don't mean that in a bad way. You know, people evolve at different times and in different ways. I just think that nobody's really, really done it yet and marketed it in a way that will get repeat business. I went to watch The Moth, actually, at Union Chapel. And it was extraordinary. It was amazing. And I just the way it was done was so much better than anything I've ever seen. Just the diversity of the storytellers, the professionalism, the slickness, because they're already from a culture that's used to it. And I think that if it got some more exposure, I think storytelling's next. I've watched it slowly evolve over the last 10 years on the comedy circuit. There is definitely a distinct style. I was on with a couple of my good friends yesterday, and they were kind of telling yarns, very West Country type yarns, very funny, joke-based, lots of laughs as well. I've got to add that. But it's going to take time for it to really catch on and become a thing. And it's just that simply that no one has done it yet. That's all it is. And yes, of course, the stand-up culture has been around since the 80s, isn't it, really? And storytelling, I think, has been very popular. I'd like to know when The Moth started. I can't think when it was, but it must be 15 years, I would have thought. Maybe longer than that. I'd have to look that up. You'd think if I was that passionate about storytelling, I'd know what date it was. But it's still relatively new compared to stand-up over there. And it might take off over here.
Do you think then, so if storytelling used to be perceived as this thing that you did when you weren't funny?
Yes.
I mean, do you think that's still a stigma attached to... Because if you're just starting out as a storyteller, statistically, like with being a comedian, you're not going to be that funny at it very early on.
Yeah.
So do you think it's a case of people go to an open mic night, see 12 comedians and one person doing storytelling that wasn't very funny, and they sort of pigeonhole it and go, well, they didn't even have a joke? Or, do you think that perception is still there?
Absolutely, yeah, of course. If people don't know what it is, then and they can't understand it, how can they want to see more of it or want to encourage it? There's some truly horrific stand-ups out there as well. I don't say that with anybody in mind, but I do see an awful lot of rambling. People talk about joke, but I see comedians walk out, I'm not criticising anybody, but by the time you've said, oh, hi, how are you guys? Are you well? Give me a cheer on three if you're well. Give me a cheer on three if you're not well. One, two, three. Give me a cheer if you've got a dog that was maybe well at some point. This can drag on and on and on. So just because something is storytelling or something is stand-up, it doesn't mean that one is any better than the other. You know, good stand-up is good stand-up. Good storytelling is good storytelling. I think with the storytelling, there is a license to not be funny. I think that the humour can actually emerge from the narrative. And I've actually seen people who've never been on stage before, because that was the idea of natural born storytellers. Literally, the clue's in the title, people who are naturally good at telling yarns. A great friend of mine told a story for about 6 minutes about how a time he was shaking like a leaf, about how him and his friend stole a car, sprayed it the same colour as a police car, and instead of police, wrote the word polite on the side and went around stopping motorists. And the audience were not only rapt, but killing themselves laughing. And he was this geezer and he was saying, well, you know, I mean, I'm nervous about public speaking. I don't know what to do, but I stole this car. And they were howling with laughter all the way through. There are no recognisable jokes, but the humour came out from the way that he delivered it. And I suppose from the believability of his character. And there was definitely, without him realising it, he used a number of techniques that really made his story brilliant. Equally, there's people who've just gone up there and been thoroughly dull. I think one of the reasons, and I say this respectfully, and Charlie Harrison from Spark would say this as well, storytelling is quite middle class and twee. You know, it just is. I mean, I've heard lots of people say, well, when I did my gap year in Peru, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'd love to go to Peru, you know, but... So it tends to be middle class and twee and actually quite safe. And sometimes people, when you try to have an edgy night, that can go too much the other way as well. Because once again, people don't really know what it is. There were times at Natural Born Storytellers have been amazing nights. But equally, there's been nights where it's just been like therapy for the audience and it's been too dark. And you've had themes like, because there's always a theme at storytelling night. So there's been themes like, I've never told anyone this before. And so by the time you've got the third person who told you they've had a difficult childhood, you can just strap in for something of a snooze fest, which is not a phrase I ever thought I'd use. And I would tell you to edit that phrase out because I feel bad. But no, let's just keep it in anyway.
Okay.
Matt Price, unedited.
Snooze fest. All storytelling nights that have a theme.
Yeah. Maybe I could have a storytelling festival and call it Snooze Fest. It could begin here.
I was going to say that's basically perpetuating the stereotype you didn't want, but that's fine.
That's fine.
I don't think the level of irony will be there in time.
Absolutely.
I mean, for me, when you were talking, I was thinking of stand-up tragedy, the night that runs.
Yeah.
I love that night. I mean, you can go, you can do stand-up, you can do a storytelling thing, you can do anything, as long as the thing is tragic.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I really love doing that gig. I really enjoy it. It's really well run. And the thing is that because it's such a variety night, you sort of go with everything. So you don't... I don't find myself watching someone tell a story going, where's the punchline?
Yes.
I find it more, oh, good, there's something interesting going to be said here.
Yes.
It might be funny. It doesn't matter if it's not, because I know it's going to be tragic either way.
Yes.
Because of the theme. So, I mean, there are nights like that, and I think... When there's a theme, it sort of binds the stories into a bigger narrative.
Absolutely, yes, of course. You know, and I love that. Yeah, the bigger narrative of the night. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Mm. What I would say as well,
it's something you don't get in comedy nights. You know, someone can go up and do a set about science and then maths and then whatever, and it's all jokes, but it's not got that bindingness to it.
Yes, that's true. Sometimes the thing that binds them is, you know, at certain nights where there's lots of acts on, especially new material nights, or new act nights, regrettably, I understand why it has to be this way. You might get 16 people, and by the time the ninth one has said, how are you? You well? You know, you do tend to want to gouge out your own eyes. It can't be helped. And that's what binds the night. Mm. What I would say about storytelling is that whilst I don't like it when people say, oh, there's no pressure to be funny, I come back straight away with, yeah, but there's a pressure to tell a good story. That as a comic, when you sit down, because you used to sit down at Natural Born Storytellers, when you sit down and you tell a yarn, and we didn't use a microphone, there's something very empowering about that. It's great to really get... I've never been afraid of silences. Couldn't care less. But it's really good to be able to sort of sit there and share a silence with an audience. Obviously, you can't do that in a stand-up environment. If you're too quiet for too long, people will either start talking over the top of you or they'll heckle. But in terms of evolving as a comic, it's really good to actually go along and tell a story and not worry about being funny. You learn an awful lot about your own vulnerability, where your limits are, about your stagecraft, about how to connect with the crowd as well, because all that's really important. Because so often in stand-up, it's how many times have you heard, well, it's the way he or she tells it.
When you were starting out,
yeah,
how many pure storytelling nights were you able to get on to perfect? I mean, were you always a storyteller, or did you go through stand-up and then got to storytelling?
I've experimented. I started in 2001. I dabbled for on and off. I did the Laughing Horse Final in 2004. 2006 was when I decided I wanted to tell stories. I've always done stand-up. I've always been able to. I wanted, because the people I really like in comedy are the people who can play any room or aspire to it. So the likes of, for example, Janie Godley, who I think is fantastic. She's the first person I saw in 2004, I think it was. I saw her two nights in a row. She did an hour-long show that was just amazing. It was funny, and when she wasn't being funny, she was being genuinely fascinating. The following night, she did a half-an-hour set, and it was a stand-up set. She interacted with the audience. I can remember somebody shouting out, "Glaswegian transvestite junkies." And I don't know how she did it, but she managed to make a routine about it with the guy on stage. And it was truly extraordinary. And I thought, yeah, I want to be able to do that. So all the people who I like are actually very versatile. Because the reality of live comedy is that you do have to be versatile. Because there's more to comedy than just comedy clubs. So you should be able to turn up anywhere and entertain people. And that was what I wanted to be able to do. My particular preference was telling stories just because it's a West Country thing. Some of the things that I've experienced, I wanted to be a professional boxing writer. That was my thing. So I wanted to be able to share their stories on stage. So I've experimented and made all the mistakes. When I initially started, I had essentially an afro, I would say, and a long trench coat, and I spoke about Japanese suicide. Because they say talk about what you know. I thought I'd make it easy for myself. Yeah. And I've tried every style since. As I said, I don't view any... Every gig I view as an opportunity. But I know myself so well now on stage, I feel that I know how to pitch it. And as a comic, I think that's what you should be able to do. So I'm a comic storyteller, or I'm a comic interactive narrative storyteller.
It's a bit of a mouthful, that one.
Yes, no, it certainly is, yeah.
Okay, no, I was only asking because I was told, and I don't know if this is true, when you started, you were unemployed, and you signed on to a scheme that was sort of to help you get into... is that right?
Do you know what? I thought that was going to be a really good marketing device when I started, but actually it's not that big a deal because there's lots of tax credit comics out there. And yeah, I mean, I basically went along to the job centre. I was on the call centre circuit in Cardiff, and having dabbled in London for a bit, moved back to Wales, and by the call centre circuit, you just work everywhere. I did British Gas and then got fired from 118. And then went upstairs to IT, and I couldn't do IT, so I got fired from that. Then I went to Western Power, so I did the whole circuit. I must have done it two or three times. I was on the dole for a while. I had a philosophy degree, and I remember turning up to the job centre, and the guy saying, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I want to be a comedian." And he sort of shook his head, and I said, "Oh, yeah, okay, well, good luck with that." But he said, "Well, actually, you can do this. You can sign up for New Deal, and you can be self-employed." And I thought, yeah, all right, I'll try and do that. And he said, "You might as well, because this call centre thing isn't working out for you." You know, so I did. And thankfully, some years later, I actually saw him at the Glee Club. Right. I was on at the Glee, and it was really great. And I said, "I can't believe this. You know, you're my New Deal advisor. How are you?" He said, "Yeah, I'm doing all right. I'm on a first date, so please don't lay into me." And I didn't, but we had a little bit of fun. So actually, it was a reasonable way out. It's one of those things. This is a very hard game, as you know. Make no mistake about it. You know, there's no blueprint for it. There's no set way to make it. There's some received wisdom. There's one or two people who can say, okay, I'll do a year on the open mic circuit. I'll develop my material. I'll get in with this person and this person. I'll go to Edinburgh, do a three-hander. Following year, two-hander with someone who's not quite as good as me. So hopefully I get a better review. I'll then get signed, get an agent to get me on at the Pleasance. I'll do 7:30. I'll win the newcomer, do 2 years of telly or maybe a year of telly tour. Then 5 years after that, I can retire. That is one path, and only a very, very, very small percentage of people do that. And good luck to them, you know. But the rest of us, it's kind of scraping a living and fighting for it. That's what you have to do, which is why I say it comes back to, well, you know, the ability to be able to play any room for me.
It makes you more commercially viable.
Absolutely, yeah, of course it does. Yeah, I personally, forget that I'm being slightly flippant when I talk about being an interactive postmodern storyteller. Listen, I want to be known. If I'm known as anything, I want to be known as a guy who can turn up and do a job really well, consistently well.
Yeah, no, I'm aboard with that.
And that's it.
My follow up question to the original point was, because you've sort of mentioned that there aren't many storytelling nights, or there aren't much of even of a circuit over here.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wondered how you were able to go full time from that, but it sounds like you were doing comedy clubs. But then I was thinking, if you were doing comedy clubs and it's not, and storytelling isn't established over here, I was wondering how you even got full time. Do you know what I mean? Because if promoters don't know what you're doing, or they don't have as many slots for that as they might do for just straight stand ups.
Oh yeah.
I how did you even get from, because if someone's listening to this and they want to be a storyteller, how did you even get to a stage where you got the trust of promoters to do either MC spots or club spots with a story rather than a just a gag type thing?
Which because is... I was very thorough in learning my trade, for one thing, so I got to the point where I felt that I could be consistent, reliable on stage. Plus, there is something of it's a misconception, really, that it's not gag, because actually it is, it can be. It can be laugh, certainly, depending on how you exploit the mechanics of being with an audience. You know, I deliberately contrive it sometimes so that someone's going to heckle me, because I know I've got a couple of comebacks that'll get laughs. I also know if I do an act out, that'll get a few laughs as well. And I very much think about, right, well, what do I want this audience, how do I want the audience to react and when? I'll go for a minimum of 3 laughs a minute. Of course, I'd be a fool not to. In Edinburgh, that's a slightly different thing. You have a longer time. I like to have 2 dips over an hour. I think that's perfectly acceptable to do that. So actually, I started off just wanting to be as funny as possible. I then thought, well, I really want to learn how to tell very funny stories. And if you look at the people who were the best at telling stories, it may not be gag as such, but it's laugh. Listen to someone like Birbiglia. You know, he uses all different techniques. He uses his voice so brilliantly. So I count myself, and almost it could sound like I have an inferiority complex, and I genuinely don't. I consider myself to be a working professional, postmodern, interactive, narrative storytelling comedian.
I was, that's fair.
That was a joke, by the
yes,
way.
Yes, I'm aware. I was literally thinking to myself, if I don't laugh at this, it would be really nice and awkward for everyone listening.
I think it's great. No, I'm glad you laughed, but I'm also, if you didn't, that would be great as well.
I would sound
like such an idiot, because if you edited that as the little snippet at the start of the podcast, this is a glimpse behind the podcast, by the way, ladies and gentlemen who were listening, sorry. Mm. But if you edited that bit with no laughter, that would just sound ridiculous. People would switch off, and it would be the one that people are least inclined to listen to.
No, I think you'd be surprised. I think people would listen to it going, this pretentious, right, I'm going to listen to it the whole way to my next gig.
Yeah.
And I hope he's there. Yes. And pick him up on this. I mean, like, where was your interactive storytelling?
Absolutely. No, I'm aware that I've sort of set myself up for something of a fall, but I'm all right with that. I've fallen before.
Mm. And I mean, the interesting thing for that is yes, everyone, I think when you start in comedy, your main aim should be just to be the funniest you can be.
Absolutely.
And that should continue through, but then obviously it changes as you sort of, your persona changes as well as your stage dynamic. But I think the interesting thing would be how you, I mean, yes, there's a consistency and there's being funny, but was it just performing open spots for different promoters that proves that you are not only funny, but that what you're doing is something that's different enough that they should book you more often in a way? Because, you know, if you're just a comedian going to do 15, 20 minutes of jokes, there's hundreds of those. Not in a flippant way, but there are. But if you've got a story to tell that's a funny story, they can put you on in between 2 of those 20-minute comedians, and it's something different, and it makes the night more interesting, and it keeps people engaged in some instances. So was it a case, how did you win over a promoter in that respect?
Well, because I don't just tell a story for 20 minutes. And also, you know, this is the thing about knowing yourself and also knowing your stories. For example, I'd tell a story about going to Broadmoor, and that story can be 2 minutes long or it can be 20 minutes long. And if I'm doing a 20-minute club set, I'll generally do it in about 3 minutes with as many laughs as possible. Mm. And I bring a certain dramatic tension to it as well and puncture that silence and end on a couple of jokes. So it's useful to know yourself and to know your range. Mm. And that's it. And how did I do it? Well, you turn up and you do your open spots and you think, well, if I'm doing a 10-minute open spot at somewhere like the Glee, I'd be a fool to do a 10-minute story. Of course. Because what if it goes wrong? So actually, I'm better to walk out. I'll walk out and I will do joke, and I'll interact and I'll make it look like I'm improvising. Sometimes I will improvise. I might start a story. I can abandon it because the audience don't really know. All they care about is whether they're entertained, whether they're laughing or not. So I haven't actually pigeonholed myself. I'm, you know, what the intrigue for me is actually where I go next. And that I'm not entirely sure of, although I'm working on it. So in terms of what a promoter wants, I think a good promoter will actually tell you what they want. You know, a good professional promoter spends a lot of money promoting their club, puts a lot of time and a lot of love and a lot of effort into it, and they will actually tell you, so what are your lot like? Oh, they're a little bit older. And so you can adapt to it accordingly. And that's one of the things. So it's always come back to being professional, being funny and being adaptable.
Definitely. How many at the moment, on average, how many gigs are you doing a week or a month, whichever you want to do it?
16, probably. I mean, I always go to new material nights as well now. So I've actually started to do more because obviously Edinburgh's coming up. So, you know, Fridays and Saturdays I've got covered. You know that the circuit is in an interesting state at the moment.
Yeah.
I am able to get the, you know, some Thursday gigs. They're quite rare now. So a Sunday gigs, unfortunately. I'm looking at doing different projects as well. I might be doing kind of a theatre show with a couple of former criminals, which will be story-based, actually, which will be interesting, fascinating. Yeah. I've known them for a few years now. So my main thing is I'm going to survive no matter what.
That's good.
And that's it. And I don't say that aggressively or nastily, but I'm going to survive.
Oh, no.
I'm a survivor.
I didn't. Sorry, in my head I had the song playing then.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Of course, so did I.
Yeah, yeah. It's just one of those things, isn't it? You can't.
You can't say phrases like that without thinking of that song or Beyonce.
Yeah, I was talking to Charlotte Austin at Catface the other day, yeah. And she just wrote to me a question, and I wrote, "Tell me what you think about this." And she was like, "What are you on about?" And I sent her a link, and she went, "Oh, yeah, I forgot about that."
Yeah, yeah.
I know,
it's unavoidable.
Yeah, I know, it's unavoidable. You can't help it. No, I'm just trying to paint a picture for someone who maybe wants to become a storyteller and how what their diary would look like, because as a comedian, I'm a comedian, I don't call myself an interactive story billboard telling.
Well, no,
I don't have any of those
absolutely.
Yeah. I tell jokes. I have stories, but I don't put myself in that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for me it's interesting to know how many gigs you do a month, how you know, like you said, the split of the open mic to paid, also like what else you do, because I think it's very hard now, almost impossible, to just be a jobbing performer. I mean, you can make a base level income on it,
yeah,
if you do every night, but I don't think most people are able to either get that in or
it is becoming very difficult, which is why I think it's more.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Than ever now, it's important to be versatile with what you do. You know, the idea for me was I'm going to run a storytelling night again, and I want to see if I can be the person who does make it accessible to people. Mm. So I'm always thinking about other streams of income and other ways to survive and other ways in which I can perform. You know, and I'm glad, lucky enough to be able, I think, to turn my hand to different things. In terms of being a storytelling comic, look at someone like Nick Page. Have you seen Nick Page?
I know of him.
Nick Page is great. Nick Page is very, very good indeed. And he can play any room. He's another person who can play any room. You can put Nick in a corporate room, a weekend club. He could be anywhere. He could come along and storm a storytelling night if he wanted to. And it is laugh after laugh after laugh. It's relentless. His stream of words is just relentless. And it's fantastic. But the one thing, and I'm sure I'm not putting words into his mouth, he's an old pal of mine, but he can play any room. So I don't think, if you're thinking of yourself as, oh, how do I start out? How do I become a storyteller? Well, don't. You're a comedian who tells stories. You wouldn't say to me, you wouldn't ask me the question, well, you know, if you're a one-liner comedian, what sort of career do you have? Well, because you're just a comedian. That's what it comes down to. You know, the main thing is being a comic. I'm a comic first. And my speciality, or my main goal, actually, is I want to do really good hours. That's really what I want to do. Ultimately, that's what I want to get on television. People are really surprised. You want to get on television? Really? Yeah, you're damn right I want to get on television. Absolutely. You know, I want to get on Russell Howard's Comedy Central. That's what I want to do. I've said it now. People don't believe me. They think I'm lying. Well, do you not want to be like a cult? No, I want to eat. You know, and I want to be able to go as far as I possibly can.
You mentioned playing any room, and I know there's a split. Well, I feel there's a split anyway between comedians who feel they should be able to play any room and comedians who just feel like, you know, not every space is conducive to stand-up, so why would I want to try and play every room? And I'm wondering, first of all, if that attitude is more prevalent in storytelling, as in storytelling comedians, sure. Or whether it's a case of... first of all, answer that.
Well, the desire to play any room, it stems from practicality more than anything. That's all. It comes back down to, you know, to pounds and pence in a way. You know, I want to be able to earn my living anywhere. But it's also very satisfying. And also, don't forget that how many times have you done a room where people said, oh, the room is so nice, there's such a lovely crowd, and you turn up and it's just the worst gig you've ever done. You think, how on earth did that happen? There's a misconception. Oh, Edinburgh audiences, they're so erudite. Really? Go to the Three Sisters or Cowgate on a Saturday afternoon when there's rugby on, and get out there and, you know, no one's ever heckled with, hey, pal, you know, make sure your narrative arc works. Yeah. They don't do that. So actually, so-called nice rooms can be tough as well. So from my point of view, it's after a while, everything becomes a variation on a theme, you know, as far as heckles go, as far as rooms go. So you can just tick stuff off, especially when you're starting out. That's what I tell people in my workshops. When you're starting out, you're learning so much with every gig. And now I can turn up, and I'm not really fazed by anything. I was very, very shy when I first started doing comedy, very shy. I couldn't even look at the audience. You know, I was terrified. And yes, it took 10 years to get good at it. I'm not ashamed to say that. But right now, I'm not afraid of anybody or anything, not a thing, because I feel like I've seen it all. And yes, it means that I'm not on telly or anything yet, but, you know, I feel like I've thoroughly learned my trade. So it is really good to be able to play any room. There is, of course, the argument, well, hang on, why would Josie Long want to be able to play a rowdy room on a Friday night where they shout abuse at her? Well, yeah, if you've got your own audience, great and well done, and she's thoroughly deserving of that audience too, I have to say. But for the reality, or my reality, is the one that I'm most concerned with, and so in order to evolve properly, I had to be able to play any room, and it's just immensely useful. I can turn up and grind out a win if I have to, or most of the time I can do very well. Most of the time it's really good. Occasionally I think I've reinvented comedy, I can't believe it, and sometimes I think, oh my God, I've left via the fire escape on quite a few occasions as well.
Do you think, as a storyteller then, and again, this is me being flippant, but do you think it's easier as a storyteller to adjust to different rooms than it would be for a stand-up? Because I find if I'm emceeing, I can adjust to rooms a lot easier than when I'm doing a set, because my set's already set. It's in the name, in a way. Whereas a story, like you said, you can take something and make it 2 minutes or 20 minutes. So you can. I feel like just from the way you're talking, you can adjust a lot easier and a lot more on the fly than maybe a performer who's got their...
I think if you know yourself well enough and you have enough skills that you can act, because sometimes I walk out and I won't tell a story at all. Sometimes you can go half an hour if you're closing and you don't even get a joke out or anything. You're just interacting with the audience. And that just comes through experience as well, and knowing what tool to present to the people in front of you. So whilst I ideally want to be able to do an hour with an amazing arc to it, and I want people to leave outside chatting and going, wow, this is just the best thing I've ever seen, the harsh reality is at some point, someone 25 minutes in the nicest room in Edinburgh is going to shout something that, you know, that involves your mum and various sexual activities, and I've got to be able to come back with something.
Definitely. And, you know, you find, sort of, let's keep with Josie Long just as an example, you find when you have your own audience, they'll go a lot more. I think we were talking about this before, where I was saying, when I spoke to Oliver Double, he said that his theory on being funny is just convincing yourself and then them that you're going to be funny. So if you have your own audience, you've kind of won that battle, which means it's kind of not easier, but I think, in fact, yeah, it probably is easier to say something or almost anything.
Yes.
And they'll, because it's like chatting with a mate, you can say something a little bit more risque or a little bit less politically correct to a friend, and they'll know who you are and be like, oh, I'll let it go, because it's that kind of person. So my question to you was going to be, first of all, what kind of audience do you think you have, and what are you doing to kind of build your audience more?
I don't have an audience. It's as simple as that. I don't. I have the audience here in front of me, you know, because I'm a circuit comedian. So I turn up, and whenever I do festivals, if it's in Australia, if it's in Edinburgh, I show up and I play to the people in front of me. And I use my skills probably on the fly to be able to create a narrative or to tell my story, but also to make some kind of narrative with the crowd as well. So there's two things going on as well. There's a narrative within the room, but there's also the story that I'm telling. So it makes it almost unique for them. I have no illusions at all that I have an audience. Would I like to have one? Yeah, probably. I'd like to get on Radio 4. I would.
So are you... are you doing that as a conscious decision, or are you just not investing time into doing that? Because it sounds like if you don't have an audience, or you just have the audience presented in front of you who don't know who you are. I mean, you were talking a lot about perceptions in your course and playing with those and stuff. So there's a lot of advantages of not knowing the audience and not having them know you, because like you said, you can play with that and you can have a lot of fun with it. So are you doing it as a conscious decision so that you still have to stay on your toes and as gig ready as you can be, because they don't know you, so you have to keep those skills sharp? Or are you just not investing time into, say, talking to them afterwards and saying, hey, join my mailing list, join my Twitter, join my whatever it would be?
Well, in many ways, I think that I possibly made a mistake. You see, of course, it's show business, isn't it? And I never focused on the business side of it at all. All I wanted to do was be a good comic. Now, I'm at a point where actually, no, I'm starting to think about, right, what's my branding? You know, so I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to get my photos taken by Steve Ullathorne, you know, and I'm going to describe myself as this thing, and I'm going to make sure that my clips are filmed well. So there is there is that side as well. I kind of wish that I thought about that 10 years ago, but then it was a different scene then, and all I wanted to do was be good. And now I believe that I am good. Now I want to be successful. And there's a difference. You can be really good at comedy, but, you know, there's people who aren't really good who are successful. I'm not going to name anybody. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. But there's a difference. So it's like, yeah, I've got good. Now how do I become a success? And I suspect that I ought to be saying to audiences, well, you can see me on, you know, you can tweet me, you can follow me on Facebook, you can email me if you want, you know, you can take my business card. So I should be working more on self-promotion, and maybe I will. Because I think that there's no coincidence it's not random that people become successful. You can sit around waiting.
It can be.
Oh, it can be.
Yeah, sorry.
But for the most part, if you sit around waiting to be discovered, or you're hoping that you're going to be the word of mouth phenomenon in Edinburgh, then you could be waiting for a very long time. You know, I've done some very good shows, I think, in Edinburgh. But, you know, I'm very much aware that this year, and I've learned a lot as I'm going as well. I've been learning about the marketing side. Mm. You know, I've managed to market Martha McBriar rather well. And I'm savvy enough to know to mention her name in a podcast that's going to be listened to by hopefully quite a few people. It's my missus. I know exactly how to market her. And she's happy just to go along with it. She's similar to me, but she, you know, she cares about being a good performer. She really does tell pure stories, and they're fantastic. They're very funny.
and she'll thank me for mentioning her because she'll be listening to this. So
it's one download.
Whereas absolutely, yeah. But whereas say even 5 years ago, I wouldn't have even had the audacity. It's not particularly audacious to even say that in the middle of your podcast. But now, whilst I'm making a joke about it and we're being lighthearted, I'm very much aware of the need, even when, and I'm thoroughly enjoying your company, Simon, even when we're talking about storytelling, I'm thinking, yeah, okay, don't forget anything. Yeah, remember yeah. this, remember that. And not because I'm cynical, but it's just what you have to move with the times. So
I don't think that's a problem at all. I think when it gets bad is when you have, so I've had some PRs on here, and you know, you have to sort of watch out for them just plugging things, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Which is fine, because that's what they do, or that's part of what they do.
Absolutely, of course it is.
But it's not, this isn't for that. This isn't
no,
a,
no,
this
of course
isn't
not.
This is a discussion
of
about the industry
it is.
And stuff.
Yeah,
so yeah, if you want to mention something, because it's relevant as well. It's something that's to do with you and it's to do with storytelling. So
yes.
it's not you just sort of going, oh, by the way, I've also got a free fringe show coming. You know, like it's
of course not. Yeah. No, I wouldn't dream of doing that. And that was more supposed to illustrate in a slightly flippant way what my journey has been. Because people emphasize different things when they start. You know, I've met people who have literally done half a dozen gigs, and one guy walked off stage and he said to me, you know, that was my seventh gig and I found what I want to do now for the rest of my life. I haven't seen him since. I don't know what he wanted to do. Maybe that was it. Maybe he meant they didn't want to do comedy anymore. Some people hand you a business card after gig number 9, and good luck to them. You know, like I said, there is no blueprint. There's no, you know, we're all self-employed in many ways, you know, scraping a living, or at least, or at the very least, wondering, you know, well, is this going to last? Where am I going to be a year from now? Is it really going to be like all the cynics are saying, and it just won't exist in 5 years? And it'll just be new material nights and open mic nights, and that's it. And we'll all talk about the good old days when you could make a living from it.
I hope not the second one. I don't know. I remember seeing a comedian, I won't mention any names, in Edinburgh 2 years ago, and they I saw their show twice accidentally. It was a long story. But they used the same flippant line twice, so I knew it wasn't an accident, as it were, where they said, when I started, it was great, and the industry was just booming, and then the bottom fell out, and now I'm good, and it's really annoying.
Yes.
And I was like, well, okay, is it though? Because I mean, you're at a higher level than I am. I mean, that's just, you've been going longer. Maybe.
No, I've been going longer than you. Yes, I don't think of it in terms of levels, but yeah, I've been going longer.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. What you? I mean, I. How can you not? I mean, you would naturally be further along this journey than I would be. Sure.
It depends. I see people, and I don't. This isn't directed at anyone in particular. I see people who can't do 10 minutes who are taking an hour-long show to the Edinburgh Festival.
Oh, yeah, I'm not.
That's incredible.
I'm not.
So they're at the same level as me. I'm doing an hour-long show.
Yeah.
All right? And someone else who's only got 10 minutes is doing an hour-long show. They'll stand on the street saying, 5-star award-winning comedy. Hardest working comedian in the UK. Do you want to come and see my show? And I'm going, oh, I've got 5 stars for this particular show. Well, so did that person down the road.
I'm not, yeah, sorry, I should explain what I mean by level. I don't, because, yeah, anyone can take an hour to Edinburgh, and there is a lot of crap.
A comic is a comic is a comic.
Yeah, what I mean is you're full time at this.
Yeah.
Is more to the point. I'm not near that at this point. I mean, okay. I gig like a full timer, but it's mainly open spots and open mics and that kind
but
of stuff at the
audiences
moment.
Don't really know the difference anyway. I think that could be partly what's contributed to the downfall anyway, is you know, you get, and you get nights where, and once again, I'm not directing this at anybody, okay? I'm not.
You do know every comedian's listening to this, like having a chat in a car going, who's he talking about?
Yeah.
Who's the night?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, they will be. But to be honest with you, I wouldn't raise it if it was directed at anybody, because it's not in my interest to do that. I don't want to be, because I've got to think about my business. I can't be slagging off anybody.
Okay.
I know.
That's
no,
why
it's
I
a shame.
You on.
I'll do it in a car. Yeah. I haven't got a problem because what happens in the car stays in the car and all that business. But often you get nights, you know, 7 award-winning comedians and it's £8 and you turn up and it's 7 open spots. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I just think, well,
don't charge £8, charge £3 and just say it's an open mic night, new exciting acts, because at least people know what it is then. You know, don't tell people that you're a 5-star award winning comedian if you got 5 stars from your mum, because it just seems like, well, you're just going to let people down. But on the other hand, it's a business. You can go from zero to being on telly in about 4 years. You can do that. What people forget as well is that people who do make it very quickly, someone like Sean Walsh. Sean Walsh is exceptionally talented, right? If you watch Sean Walsh, what he does, he is absolutely phenomenal at observational comedy. I'm going to call it that broadly. Observational humour, and he's brilliant at being Sean Walsh. He's amazing. I'm not surprised that he made it onto the telly as relatively quickly as he did. You know, but he didn't have to lie about it. You could say, well, he's got a big agent behind him. Yeah, but he, you know, he had the ability in order to do it. And I don't think he's ever had to lie to anyone or to exaggerate it. He's, you know, genuinely brilliant. People look at someone like that and think, well, if he can do it, I can do it. So I'll take shortcuts and maybe I'll exaggerate what I'm doing. And I think, well, actually, you get found out in the end, because people will come and watch your show and they'll say in reviews, you know, this person only has 20 minutes of material, and that was flabby, and that's why I'm giving them 2 stars. I don't even despise them enough to give them 1 so they can actually get a car crash audience in.
Does
that sound bitter and jaded? It's not meant to.
It's not meant to, no. I'm just thinking of how can I put it? It doesn't sound bitter and jaded. That's not something you should worry about. I'm sure there'll be one person listening to this who'll go, that does sound bitter and jaded. But, you know, the more people that...
if you are listening to this, up yours, because it's not bitter and jaded. I'm just saying it as I see it.
Yeah. And no, I just mean the more people that listen to a certain thing, the more likely you're going to get a different response from it. You know, everyone...
Well, of course. Yeah, because you know, and I might well be doing myself out of business because people will just think, oh, he's a storyteller. That's not the same as stand-up. I won't book him for my comedy club. Possibly, because obviously people are going to hear different things, and that's absolutely fine.
Yeah, totally. And if you can go from naught to TV in 4 years,
yeah,
have you got a plan to do that for yourself?
Well, no, because at the moment I don't really have anyone who can give me a plan or tell me how to do it. So in many ways, this is a cry for help. You know, I don't know how to do it.
There are TV commissioners that listen to this.
Yeah, no, the problem is. Honestly, I don't know. I'd love to know. I'd love to know what I can do in order to get that opportunity.
I emailed one recently to get them on, and they emailed back saying, yeah, I love it. I'd love to have you on. So if you want to do a quick play, you can...
Yeah, absolutely. No, if you're listening, I think I'm good. I think you're going to see people...
Don't sell yourself too high, though.
No, well, no, but, you know, I think there's going to be people out there who would like to hear what I have to say. I'm different. I'll be funny. Mm. And I think I do a great job. In terms of diversity, there aren't any Cornishmen out there, particularly. There's Jethro. There's Kerno King. Ed Rowe, who I love. There's Paul Carenza. There's Anna Curl. There's MJ Walker. And there's Graham Wilkes. And if I've left anybody out, then I do apologise. But in terms of a big lump like me, who's had one hell of a journey over the last 10 years, you wouldn't believe what I've had to go through, but who can take some of those experiences and make them genuinely funny in front of any audience. And yeah, I'd love to come and do your TV program. Sorry for marketing myself or being so blunt about it, but if you are listening and you can help me, please give me an idea. You can Facebook me, you can contact me through Simon, you can Twitter me. I'll give you my address if you want afterwards.
If you want to pop around. Well, this is the thing. As much as that is a funny plug, it does bring up a very interesting case, because I can't remember who it was who said it, but someone said about Sarah Millican that I think they said something like, she wouldn't have a career if she wasn't a woman who was Geordie or something like that. And it was in a review. And the way you just said yours was where you said, there aren't that many Cornishmen. Like, do you actually play to that? Because, I mean, you don't really have a Cornish accent from what I can... It doesn't really...
Not particularly, no. It depends on the crowd. If I'm in the West Country, I might West Country it up a little bit more. I'd be a fool not to postcode the gig. You know, a lot of people do that. Sarah Millican's great.
Oh, no.
She would make it anyway.
Sorry.
She's so good at comedy.
I should say, I'm not criticising her in any way. I'm quoting a review and I just can't remember who.
But she's just so good that it wouldn't really matter what she was. I think that it's easier to be able to define someone very quickly. And that's what that is. You know, she wouldn't have to be a Geordie. You could just go, wow, you know, just a really likeable, next door neighbour sort of talking to you over the fence almost is one way of marketing it. Very talented, very marketable.
What's really nice is every time you have, every time you talk about storytelling or every time you talk about something in that area that you have skill in, you flip a negative to be a positive like that, which is really good, I think, especially in this, because because I think too many comedians go, I can't do one-liners, I'll do this instead, and they look at it in a negative way rather than, I do this thing well, though, forget one-liners, I do this thing, you know what I mean?
So I
like that, and I think that confidence comes out in the fact that you've done it for so long.
Yeah.
That you believe in yourself, even though
absolutely.
But like you said, you're not marketing yourself to get an audience. Even when I said, "Go ahead, pitch yourself to a commissioner," you go, "I think I'm good." Like you're not arrogant enough to go,
well, no.
"I'm the hardest working storytelling person on."
Maybe I should have said that. I'd like to be able to say that, but it's ridiculous. You know, I think that because there's so many comics, there are less opportunities. On all really, on a serious note, if there's anybody listening, I'd love to have an opportunity.
I would as well, by the way.
And
just throw it out.
No, we all would. Everybody I know would. You know, there's people running around in the background now taking tables everywhere. They probably love an opportunity as well.
Do you guys want to pitch? No, we're not turning this into that.
That'd be great.
I think we've got a few minutes before we've got to be kicked out of here. So I'll quickly ask you, because I had a few questions about Edinburgh.
Yes,
because I know your first show, what I've got told, was 2006. When you went to Edinburgh and you didn't have a venue.
That kind of fell through. I turned up and it was in the garden of Lindsay's bar, and they had a barbecue, so that was fine, because I spoke to Claire Smith from The Scotsman, who's a reviewer, a journalist who is very good, excellent journalist actually, and she gave me my first quote. I think she said I tell fascinating stories from behind the ropes, because I wanted to talk about boxers, and it's still a show that I will do at some point.
Awesome.
But that's the swan song show, that's the retirement show.
Cool. And so the two questions, main questions for Edinburgh, because I know we've got to move in a sec. The two main questions about Edinburgh I've got for you are, one, do you list yourself in storytelling? And if you don't, why don't you?
Oh, no, I list it as stand-up storytelling.
Okay.
Yeah, I think last year was true life storytelling. I don't think people particularly look at it, to be honest. I don't think they care. I think as long as you've got a decent mugshot and the person on the flyer says, "Oh, hi, do you want to come and see a show? It's 5 stars and award-winning." Although they don't do that with me, because I've had some 5-star reviews, but I haven't won an award. Although we got third place in a raffle once when I was a kid, and maybe that counts. Doesn't have to say award what you won the
award. Comedy
award
winning, yeah.
No, I think that I always take the approach to Edinburgh. I'd like to try to speak to people myself. I do the showcase gigs and I say, listen, this is something slightly different. Come along. There's a narrative. If you like a good yarn, you'll like it. There's jokes in there. It's funny. It's personal. And that's almost enough to get people in. So I think that the marketing in the brochure, you only have 40 words and about 90 online. So you more or less sound the same as everybody else, really. But I think that people have a greater understanding now of what storytelling is, or postmodern narrative comedy is.
Yeah, that makes sense. No, I just wondered, because we all have a hard time in Edinburgh. We're all whoring ourselves out
course,
the whole time.
Absolutely.
But I was wondering whether being a storyteller makes it easier or worse at festivals for you, because at comedy sections, you know, I'm competing against every other comedian, essentially, whereas are you competing in that way? I mean, you're a comedian who tells stories, but you have a thing where you can go up to someone and say something a bit different. You know what I mean? You've instantly got that.
I don't think it's that different. It's just an Edinburgh show.
Okay.
To be honest with you, it is just an Edinburgh show.
Okay.
Not in a bad way, but, you know, I'm up the same as everybody else, you know, stood in the rain trying to fly at people, convince them that I'm worthy of coming to see.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, most of the time, you know, touch wood, I get people in. I'd have to necessarily tell it as storytelling. I think a personal sales pitch is good to people.
Yeah.
If you say to people, look, I've got a show and I'd love to run it by you. I'd love to know what you think. And people will come along.
Are you one of the mythical, profitable Edinburgh people?
I do all right. I do okay out of it. Yeah, certainly. I think, do I make loads of money? No, because I tend to do the free fringe. I can cover my costs of being up there, and that's quite a blessing, you know, given how expensive accommodation is. So I do enough to be able to go back the following year, really, is what it's about. I more or less make my money back. And can afford to eat whilst I'm up there. But the personal growth that you get is incredible, as you know.
Yeah.
But I'm at that point, you're speaking to me now, at the point where I want to be a commercial success. So I need to start acting like it. And that's my next mission.
So What steps are you taking to be taken more seriously? I mean, not that you're not being taken seriously,
no.
But what steps are you personally taking? And also, I think you're with Murph Management.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So what are you and Murph working on together that is getting you to be taken more professionally?
Okay, I don't quite know how to say this, but me and Murph aren't working on anything. Jeff gets me gigs. There's no point, because people are going to... This is the bit that people are going to pause in the car now and go, oh, I can't wait to hear what he has to say about this. Jeff's very good at what he does. Jeff is very good at getting you gigs, and that's it. And that doesn't mean... I'm not being disparaging about him. I'm very grateful for that. But in terms of me being able to go further, I'm probably going to have to come up with my own business plan. And I'm not saying do it myself. Jeff will admit it. He'd give me a bread and butter income. But I do so much more than just his gigs. So much more. Because I built up a reputation. However, if I
want to... Are you also on the corporate circuit, I assume?
Or? Not the corporate circuit. I do the odd corporate. But I do the overseas gigs. I've been to Asia and closed over there. That wasn't through Mirth Control. I got that myself. And... I did the Australian festivals. Jeff's been, what can I say? I don't know how to describe it, really. Jeff is very good at what he does. And take that in any way you like, any way you choose. But I think that even he would say that in order for me to get to the next level, I'm going to have to do it myself. Not because he doesn't care, but because it's not what he does. So I'll continue to do the Mirth gigs, I'll continue to get the circuit gigs that I get myself, and I'll continue now to market myself. And my goal this year is to get more journalists in. I've always had, the last few years, touch with very good reviews, but I'd like to get... I saw Sarah Kendall's show. My goodness me. If you want to go and see stand-up storytelling at its absolute best, go and see Sarah Kendall. Me and Martha McBriar, my missus, 5 stars in the Scotsman she got last year. We went to watch the Radio 4 recording of Sarah Kendall, and all I can say is that is next level stuff right there. We were both absolutely blown away. And Sarah deservedly got nominated, but I think she had 18 reviewers in. I had 3. All right. I got 3 5-star reviews.
PR,
I don't know who the PR was, possibly Mel Brown, who I'd love to have. Of course, if I had the money, it would be very much worth it. But my point being that I think that actually I ought to be able to get more. I'm not saying I'm going to get 17 or I deserve it. It's not about what you deserve, but the next level for me is certainly to market myself in such a way as I can entice journalists in now. I can say, look, this is my 6th Edinburgh show. How about you, throw me a bone, and review me. And so that's how I've changed. That's where my focus is going.
Okay. These are the final quick-fire questions
course,
that I do.
Yeah.
They're quick for me. You can take as long as you want to answer them, although we are probably going to get thrown
out any minute
now.
I
was going to ask what's the best show you've ever seen, but I'm assuming it would be Sarah Kendall's at the moment.
Sarah Kendall's was brilliant. I've got to say, actually, I know I'm biased, but my missus, in 2006, she did a show called Sex, Kitten, Corpse. It was entirely improvised. She got a 5-star review. 2007, she did... another show. She was attacked, ended up with a brain tumor, which is a story I've told quite a lot to people. Could no longer perform. 10 years later, after doing a storytelling night, she did a narrative show and got another 5 stars in The Scotsman. Her show last year, Pigeon Puncher, was extraordinary. I know this is the woman I love, but she's really, really good.
That's the reason you love her. Yeah.
Well, of course, yeah, but she's a very, very talented woman. Mm. But that aside, yeah, Sarah Kendall, my God. I didn't even know how to speak to her afterwards. I said, I was blown away. It was wonderful. Thank you. Because I didn't want to sort of be too gushing. But extraordinary. I felt like I'd seen something. I felt like I'd seen something amazing. And it was. Like I'd almost seen something... genre, like boundary pushing in a way.
Nice.
It was amazing. Yeah. 6 times in 10 years have I been genuinely blown away and just thought, God, I don't even know what that was. It's so good. It almost defies analysis. It was that good. Rather like Sean Hughes' Alibis for Life. Listen to that album. Changed my life.
What is the biggest mistake you've ever made and how did you get over it?
The biggest mistake I ever made was not really understanding that it is show business. I think if you're starting out, think about the business side seriously. Focus on trying to be funny. I think that's very helpful. But give equal time to being able to network and to promote yourself as well. I guess it's more competitive now. There's more comedians than there are gigs. And it's, you know, to quote Hills Jago, it's about networking. And I think it is. But it's also about being funny as well. Don't lose sight of the fact that you are there to try and entertain people. But I think work hard and be nice. Now, I've always been nice and I've always worked hard. But if someone has said to me, yeah, but you need to focus and actually have a really solid plan, then maybe things would have been slightly different. But having said that, you know, I'm in a position, as I said earlier on, where I'm good at comedy. And now I'd like to be a success. So at least I know that. Better late than never.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I get that feeling. Who do you think is the most underrated person in your industry?
That is a very interesting question. And I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. What I would say is that it's very easy to dismiss people. I think that the industry looks at someone and they think, oh, okay, we're going to think of you as this. And they more or less set the level for you within the first few years. And it's easy to overlook people. There are amazing comedians out there, as you know. And, you know, Adam Bloom said, you know, that he's better after 25 years than he was 25 years ago. But the audience are more or less, the industry have more or less dismissed him. We all do that a little bit. You know, and I think that that's a shame. That's the only thing I would say is, okay, you don't get an opportunity to be new. You only get one opportunity to be new, but I don't understand why people are so dismissive. You know, I took 10 years to learn how to be a comedian. It doesn't make me better or worse than anybody else, but I think, well, don't dismiss me. And am I saying that I'm the most underrated person in the industry? Well, I don't know. I'll tell you that off record.
I was going to ask, the next question was going to be, what is the biggest problem in the comedy industry and how would you go about solving it? But I think you've answered the first part of that now, or unless that's not the biggest problem in the...
Well, I think one of the problems is the actual marketing, certainly for the live circuit. I honestly think there's nothing wrong with saying to your audience, look, this is an open mic night. Don't market it as something that it's not. You know, in Edinburgh, well, I can understand why all bets are off. You know, there's something about doing the free fringe and, you know, if you end up with £1.50, €1 note and a piece of chewing gum in your bucket, that will tell you enough. And actually, if you're as deluded as I think you might be, or, you know, this is just not to anyone in particular, then you will come back the following year and do the same anyway.
Yeah. Okay. And what's the best bit of advice you have been given?
The best bit of advice. Now, I think the best bit of advice was from Martin Beaumont, who came, and I wish I knew what the... He said there are three things. You are what you think. You either want to do it or you don't, and be in the moment. That's the best piece of advice I've ever had. The rule of three. Because it really takes away any doubt.
Definitely. You know? If you could go back, I know I said that'd be the last question, okay. But I've got one more that I think you'd be fun to answer and end your pod on. If you could go back and give yourself one bit of advice before your first gig, what would it be?
It would be, don't talk about Japanese suicide. I don't think that's entirely relevant. But it would also be... this is going to take a while before you actually believe in yourself properly. And whilst, you know, maybe it's going to take you 10 years to get to the point where you think, no, I'm actually really good at this, it's going to be worth it. You know, strap in for a very... Oh, I hate the phrase strap in, but I want it to be unedited, so it's going to have to be strap in. What a horrible phrase. But I would say, you know, really brace yourself for a 10-year journey that's going to be up and down, but ultimately worth it in the end. And everyone's journey is different as well. And that's something. If anyone who's starting out is listening, trust me, you know, if you can come up with a new neurosis or a new bad experience, I'd love to hear about it, because I feel like I've seen everything and I'm still standing.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it, mate. Really have.
That was Matt. I learned loads from his course, as well as from talking to him about the art of storytelling. And I really liked talking to him about his venture into thinking more about the business side of show business. It was just a really interesting thing that someone, even with an agent, who has to sort of still take their own reins and has realized that they're going to have to make a lot of their own opportunities in certain areas of their career and the limitations on the path they've chosen as a performer who tells stories rather than is just gag, gag, gag. So I hope you got as much out of that as I did. If you would like to see Matt, he is at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival 2016. He is doing a show called Poltroon. It's a free fringe show at the Cabaret Voltaire. It's at 8:45 every night from the 4th to the 28th.
8th. If you would like more information, there is a link in the show notes. Please do support him. He supported us by giving up his time so readily, and if you've enjoyed this and you'd like to talk to him about storytelling or the art of storytelling or anything to do with this, you can tweet him, and the link again is in the show notes, or you can meet him at after one of his shows. If you'd like to support me and this podcast, please do consider sharing this link with a friend who might enjoy this or any other episode that you've enjoyed. It really helps out the show, and if you've got a minute, an honest review in iTunes would be massively appreciated as well. And if you'd like to donate some money to help this project continue, you can do that as well on my website, which is simonkane.co.uk, either with a one-off donation via PayPal or as an ongoing patron via Patreon. All links to all of those things are in the show notes and on my website, which is simonkane.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you very much for supporting. Thank you very much for donating, and I'll see you in about 10 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.